Call the meeting to order, please.
A moment of silence, please. Standing.
Pledge of allegiance, please.
To the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
We have roll call, Sherry, please.
Charlie Hopkins. Dennis Olson.
Here.
Bonnie Onion.
Here.
Harry Robinson.
Here.
Ken Oplinger.
Here.
Clark Cotton.
Here.
Paul Greeno.
Here.
Next item of business is recognition and awards. I have the pleasure providing the Blaine Builder Award to Joe
Mesh.
Joe Mesh, president of the North Cascadia Audubon.
Shall I remain seated or shall I get up?
Well, I think you can come up. We have to have pictures taken, Joe, and all the rest.
Do you have the certificate?
Joe has been watching birds for 60 years. In 2002, his efforts were instrumental in Drake Harbor and Semiahmoo becoming an important birding area, which is a designation by the National Audubon Society to identify critical habitat of birds in our state and well raise awareness of these areas and to promote stewardship, enhancement, and protection of these sites. Soon after, Joe worked to include Blaine as the Northwest anchor for the Cascade Loop of the Great Washington State Birding Trail. The trail provides the best place for the best bird watching in Washington State, which are described in full color maps with descriptions of the birds along the routes and other pertinent information of each site. These efforts have brought attention to Blaine as a premier birding site in the state, providing an opportunity for economic benefits to the community, drawing birders here from all over the state. Joe continues to share his passion of birding and showcases our area through his stunning photography, writings, wildlife field trips, as well as participating in Wings Over Water Northwest Birding Festival, which was just celebrating its 10th year. Joe has been president of the North Cascade Audubon since 2007.
Thank you.
More than welcome.
About this, I was thinking, hey, maybe a ticker tape parade. Reality set in, and I realized that ticker tape doesn't have much effect when it comes from mostly one-story buildings. So.
In addition to Joe, who is awesome, we also have a committee that has just worked really hard on Wings Over Water, and I'd like them to come forward. And I think you know who you are. That's Carl and Kathy and Carol and Jim. Yeah.
Is this a big group of people?
So we plan this event for months. It is a pretty tedious. And I have this committee that, you know, is just great to work with. They work hard, and they are a lot of fun. They don't always mind, but they're good. I love them all. So I have a certificate of appreciation for Don Bongaware, who is not here, from Peter Doctor, Eloise Nyman. They are not here today. Jim Jorgensen. He has been actually on the Wings Over Water from, I think, the very beginning. And so Kathy White, thank you so much. Kathy's our secretary. Heidi Holmes, our treasurer. Carol Solomon, who does everything. However, she says she's retiring next year and not going to really work as hard, but I'm going to bet on that she will.
Thank you guys for all of your hard work.
I'd like to say something about Debbie and her leadership. Very good. I'd like to say that without her being such a bold crab, we wouldn't get much done. She's a great, great lady to have. She is the driving force behind this whole thing.
The next order of business will be audience participation, and we have one individual who signed up to speak this evening, David Galleon. Would you come forward, please, and to the podium and state your name and address, please?
Be glad to, sir.
My name is David Galleon, and I live at 1455 Madison Avenue. Most of you know me as the chair of the Planning Commission, but I'm wearing a different hat today. I'm also the president of the Blaine Friends Library. And Debbie grabbed me today, and she said, you need to get down to the council and talk about this. So I emailed Charlie, and he didn't even email me back, so I don't know if it's on the agenda or not. But what the Friends of the Library has done or accomplished is that they formed a committee for fundraising for the new library building. I think it comes up in 2015 on the capital project. So what we would like to see as our committee, we would like to see the council consider forming an exploratory committee where we could work with you guys in raising money in the 2 years so we could move forward in getting a new library building built. And that's where I'm here. Thank you very much.
It's in Charlie's hands now?
Yeah.
Charlie, we'll work with you. Thank you, David. The next, I believe, is Susan Marks, the Bellingham Whatcom County Commission Against Domestic Violence.
Hello, everyone.
Welcome.
Good evening.
Susan.
Let's see. Okay. So I'm Susan Marks. I'm the director of the Bellingham Whatcom County Commission Against Domestic Violence. And every year I try to go around and speak to all the councils, just give them a brief update on what the commission has been doing, because we're really tasked with serving all of the municipalities and the county at large. So you have in your packets a outline of some of the things I'm going to talk about today. It's in the format of a PowerPoint, but I decided not to mess with the technology and do an actual PowerPoint presentation because they rarely work out the way we hope. So for people who don't know, just a little history is the commission was formed in 1998. It was a joint ordinance between the city of Bellingham and Whatcom County. And then in 2006, each of the other five municipalities in Whatcom County signed on with ordinances of support. So at this time, we're tasked with serving all of those communities. And our mission is to provide leadership in the community's efforts to reduce and prevent domestic violence. And what that means, it makes us different than victim service agencies or perpetrator treatment providers. That what we do is we actually try to impact the way the community responds to domestic violence, to impact change in the way the systems respond to victims and their children as well as to perpetrators. So we're really kind of looking at the broad picture of domestic violence and not at the on-the-ground level. You also have on your packets, just kind of to provide a little context for you all in the city of Blaine, every year we do bring together data from the criminal justice system and the civil justice system and put it together for each city about how domestic violence is impacting their city. And we're always just over a year behind because it takes a little while to get the data in and then get it all together. But so in 2010, that's the most recent data we have for Blaine. We'll have another report out probably in about 6 months. You can see that the Blaine Police Department responded to 43 domestic violence offenses and 66 verbal offenses. And a verbal is when the police go on the scene and there's no physical cause for them to make an arrest, but it's still considered domestic violence. And domestic violence offenses are 18% of all offenses that are reported by the Blaine Police Department in 2010. And then also there were 37 domestic violence misdemeanor charges filed in Blaine Municipal Court with 28 defendants. That means some of those defendants had more than one charge in that year. And then there were also in 2010 three domestic violence felony cases that were then referred to the Whatcom County Superior Court. If they're felonies, they go to the Superior Court. And then in January through June of 2010, the domestic violence specialist, and she is a advocate who serves victims when they have cases going through criminal prosecution. She helps victims have a voice in the process and provides them with support and information. She had 63 contacts with 19 victims in January through June and 132 contacts with 19 victims in July through December. So she really provides the victim support through that process so the prosecutor can do their job and prosecute and law enforcement can do their job and investigate. Now, I think numbers can often be a little bit confusing, and there's a lot of numbers being thrown at you, and we don't really know what that means, but the bigger question is why this really matters, and I have a small story, and it's not from the city of Blaine, but it's from our Whatcom County community, and it's happened in many of the communities throughout Whatcom County. It's the story of maybe you heard of Kristen Peterman-Dunya, who last summer she was a mother of a 7-year-old son, and she worked at Barnes & Noble. She was known as a good mother, involved in the community, a kind person. And on January 3rd, at 5 o'clock in the morning, her estranged husband walked into her house and shot her. He shot her once in the chest and she died. She left behind a 7-year-old son who at that time was on visitation with his father. Thankfully, he was not in the home. And his father left him with his current girlfriend who helped him plan the crime. And they're both currently being charged with the homicide. Now, I will say that hasn't been prosecuted yet. That keeps getting delayed. It will be prosecuted this spring. But it shows to us what can happen when domestic violence goes to its most extreme level, when it goes to the furthest end of the continuum of violence. And I think all of our goals when we look at systems change is to say, we don't want anyone to lose their life because of domestic violence. We don't want any child to lose a parent to domestic violence. It's bad enough for them to witness it in the first place, but to witness or to lose a parent to domestic violence. And then he's also lost his father because his father is no longer in the home with him. So I think that story provides us, first of all, why this is so important, and also a little context to some of the work of the DV Commission. And so you can see, if you look at your notes, we have a new strategic plan that we formed in the fall of this year, and it's going through in the fall of 2011. It'll be 2012 through 2014 we'll be implementing these initiatives. And again, I think Kristen's story shows us why some of these initiatives are important. And so some of the things that we want to do is we want to enhance our community's response to children who are impacted by domestic violence. Currently, children are often the forgotten people when law enforcement arrives on the scene, advocates respond to victims, perpetrator treatment providers are working with perpetrators, and children see a lot and they are impacted greatly by what happens in their homes. We really want to improve our community's response to those children so that they can grow up and they won't be victims and they won't be perpetrators. We also want to do a formal review of intimate partner homicides. In the last 3 years in Whatcom County, there have been 8 intimate partner homicides, which is an extremely high number. We actually, as of 2010, we were the third highest number of homicides in the state, and we do not have the third highest population by county, so it's slightly concerning that that has been happening in recent years. So we want to take a good look at some of these cases, and we want to see, is there a place where, as a community, we could intervene before it reaches the point of a homicide? And some of that may be law enforcement, and some of it may be advocates, and some of it may be finding other partners in the community, like faith-based communities, teachers, daycares, finding other people who can help us. We also want to do some follow-up on our past projects. We start a lot of projects, and we often start things, and then we get into the next thing, so the money comes in for the next thing. So we want to make sure that we don't drop our past projects. And one of those is our Domestic Violence in the Workplace initiative, where we're encouraging employers in Whatcom County to adopt comprehensive domestic violence policies and procedures so victims can take the time off that they need to get their needs met so that then they can return to work and support their families. And I will say the City of Blaine was an early adopter in this. They adopted this policy, and Sherry Sanchez and Chief Haslow came out and accepted an award for that in January. And then we're also going to do a perpetrator systems review, which we're going to kick off this fall. And we're really going to look at how the systems respond to perpetrators and see if we can build in more accountability, because one thing we've talked about is if we really want to end domestic violence, if we really want to make a big impact, we have to get to the perpetrators and we have to stop them from reoffending. You can see on our next page, we also have a few ongoing initiatives, things that we do every year. Every year we put together these data reports so people can see how domestic violence is progressing in Whatcom County. Every year we coordinate events for Domestic Violence Awareness Month in October so people can really learn more about domestic violence and we can raise the entire community's awareness. And we always put on trainings and conferences. We usually bring in some national speakers as well as local speakers, trying to provide training here locally, because one thing we know is when funding gets tight, training budgets are the first things that are cut, so if we can provide support to communities in that way, it's something that we found to be very valuable. And then we have two major grant projects, and they're both through the U.S. Department of Justice, their Office of Violence Against Women, and one is the Grants to Encourage Arrests, Grants to Encourage Arrests Program Enforcement of Protection Order Policies. It's a long one. And this is our fourth time actually receiving this grant in a row. It's a two-year grant, and it's $387,000 for 2 years, which will all go to various locations in Whatcom County. And one of the things that funds is that domestic violence specialist who is serving victims in the criminal justice system in Blaine as well as in the other cities. And it funds her fully for 2012, and in 2013 it funds her part-time, so we will be looking for funding for the other part of her position in 2013. And then we got the STEP grant, which is services training, education and policies for domestic violence, dating violence, sexual assault and stalking in secondary schools. And we actually partnered with the Ferndale School District on this grant, and it's a pilot project. We were one of only 9 sites chosen in the entire country. And we have $550,000 over 3 years to design policies and procedures and response protocols and a program to serve students who are victims. And we actually hope after that project is done to bring it to other school districts throughout the county. So if anyone has any questions for me, I know it's a lot of information. There's a lot going on, and there's a lot to be responded to if we really want to work on ending domestic violence, which we've said is our goal. If anyone has any questions, you can let me know, and otherwise you also have my contact information in your packets, and you also have in your packets a roster of everyone who's on the commission. You'd be welcome to contact any of them with questions as well.
Anyone have any questions for Susan? Susan, thank you very, very much.
Great, thank
appreciate
you.
Your presentation.
Okay, thank you.
Next, we have a gentleman by the name of Bruce Agnew, and he is with the Cascade Center for Regional, I put my glasses on, Regional Development. And we welcome you, Bruce.
I think we've got a PowerPoint, too, we're going to try to make work. And in the meantime, I want to thank Sandy for her presentation. I used to serve 2 terms on the Snohomish County Council, and criminal justice was a big part. And domestic violence was a terrible, tragic situation. So let's change the subject a little bit and talk about something I'm extremely excited about. And I'm joined tonight by Councilor Marvin Hunt from the great city of Surrey, B.C., and Councilor Grant Meyer from White Rock, B.C., your neighbor to the northwest. We're here to talk about Gateway Semiahmoo and the Blaine train station. Next slide, please. The concept, and you should have this in your handout, and for those in the audience that would like to see the handout later, I'd be happy to send you a copy of it. The concept of Gateway Semiahmoo is, first and foremost, a train station in Blaine, and I know you're going through a great discussion about the current facility and future sites. The quickest way to get a passenger train stop in Blaine is to petition Washington State right now, because they are basically going through an update of the state master rail plan for the Amtrak Cascades, and ask for a station in Blaine. And so first order of business, if you're interested, is to ensure that you communicate to the governor and legislature and WSDOT your interest. And I encourage the Canadian, our Canadian colleagues, and they will talk later about that, to petition their premier An alternative to having a train stop as part of the Amtrak Cascade service is to extend commuter rail that currently operates by Sound Transit between Seattle, Everett, and Tacoma north, originally to Bellingham, but now we're talking about going to Blaine. But to do that, to implement a new service with all the financing and governance is probably upwards of $100 million and probably years away. So the quickest way to get the train is to have the Amtrak Cascade stop. Now, if we bundle this with a third round trip that's been talked about for many years between Seattle and Vancouver, we currently have two round trips. We desperately need a third round trip, and Senator Mary Margaret Haugen, the chair of the Senate Transportation Committee, has been talking about and willing to fund a third round trip in the middle of the day. That would have the train stop in Blaine three times northbound, three times southbound. Now, there's also much discussion in White Rock, and Councilor Meyer will mention this, about extending the Esplanade and developing a bus turnaround in the Peace Arch crossing southbound around the Nexus station for folks to get dropped off and walk across the border, as they do across most borders, to a train station in Blaine. So we want to make it easier for pedestrians in transit. Now, we recognize that parking will be a challenge if you move forward with the train station, but we believe that that can be addressed, and we've got some examples of how we can move forward on that. A train stop in Blaine would be an excellent addition to what we call the two-nation vacation. The great success story of the region has been the explosion in flights at the Bellingham Airport, and all the Canadian travelers who are coming down to Bellingham Airport. So improved access, probably mostly by inner-city coach, would be part of the Gateway Semirama strategy. We're also talking about freight. You sit here in Blaine between Cherry Point and West Shore Terminals and Delta Port, so you're dealing with freight traffic every single day, and we believe that there's an opportunity to use the money that the feds have given the state to upgrade the siding at Blaine at Swift to address some of the congestion issues you have with southbound trains being inspected, blocking intersections. So there's an opportunity as part of this initiative. Next slide, please. Now, no discussion of Gateway Semiahmoo can start without incorporating the native culture and heritage. This wonderful area, and specifically the First Nation Semiahmoo, the Swanson tribe, and the Lummi tribes need to be involved early on in the project with their rich history here in the area and a great story for international travelers to discuss with. Next slide. This is remarkable. 871,000 people, nearly a million people, live south of the Fraser River. Now, most folks, I'm from Seattle, most folks travel on a train up to Vancouver, they think of downtown Vancouver. They don't have any idea of this incredible, fast-growing Fraser River Valley, mostly because the Canadians have done a heck of a job in protecting their agricultural land. And so you don't see the growth in the city. Next slide. Now, here in our area, northwest Whatcom County, the area, it depends on what you define as Gateway Semiahmoo. We tend to think about Bellingham Airport and Ferndale, and this area here is 26,000 folks. Next slide. And the biggest thing about Gateway Semiahmoo is its natural attractions, both natural and man-made. Of course, on the left, we have the wonderful Esplanade and White Rock with the train tracks and the beach. On the right, of course, the inn at Semiahmoo. We talked about birds earlier tonight. This Boundary Bay or Drayton Harbor is equidistant between South America and Central America and Alaska, so we have this great Pacific flyway with these birds transit the area and don't check them for passports either. And then and then of course Peace Arch and Crescent Beach, which is a beautiful community, you know, White Rock and the Boundary Bay Boardwalk, which is handicap accessible and was featured recently in the Seattle Times. Next slide. Now, this is the story of the Amtrak Cascades. John Seibold is the new director. He's a great guy. Comes from Bellingham, ran the airport. The thing about this is to look at the gap between the cities in this 464-mile corridor from Eugene, Oregon to Vancouver. There's a 60-mile gap between Bellingham and Vancouver. And if you look at Seattle to Edmonds, that's 15 miles. Edmonds to Everett is 15 miles. Now, this is an older map. It doesn't have a new Stanwood station. But Stanwood is 8 miles from Mount Vernon. So our pitch to the state is you've got this 60-mile gap. you're losing a lot of riders, and so there's an opportunity here to incorporate new ridership by opening up a Blaine station. Next slide. Try to go through this a little quicker. This is the ridership. It's gone up tremendously since 1994 when train service was restarted to Vancouver when Congressman Swift was here. I was working on that project back then. The biggest thing about this is that, again, if we could capture the folks that live in this area, particularly north of the border, we can increase this ridership, which means lower operating subsidies for taxpayers in the state of Washington. Next slide. These are the criteria for making a decision by WashDOT for a new train station. I'm not going to go into all the details, but if you look up operating subsidies and ridership and you work with them on, in terms of the $140 million that will be invested, new federal money that will be invested in upgrading the entire tracks from Seattle to Blaine, as well as new tracks in Everett and Blaine, we ought to be able to reduce the travel time by 3 or 4 minutes in order to justify the stop in Blaine. Next slide. And we have political support from Governor Gregoire and Premier Christy Clark, previously Premier Gordon Campbell. They've worked out a cabinet, and Ken's familiar with this, with his work with the Bellingham Chamber, that for many years has resulted in some great success stories like the enhanced driver's license. And they are looking at ways of maximizing revenues, reducing subsidies, and increasing ridership. Again, all of this fits into a new plan for Amtrak stop in Blaine. Next. I'm not going to go into a lot of details. We did a study for the Whatcom Council of Governors looking at different train technologies. On the far left is the Amtrak Cascades. On the right is the Sounder train that operates between Seattle, Tacoma, and Everett. Also, that type of train operates in West Coast Express in Vancouver. And then the DMU, which is a locomotive-less train set that carries bikes and has Wi-Fi and a bistro car. It has two staff people instead of the five or six that operate on the Amtrak Cascades, so it's cheaper to operate. And that's probably part of our future as we get into commuter rail. Next slide. Our report recommended a two-tiered service in the near future within 10 years, which would result in maybe 5 round trips serving Blaine, 3 express international service, and 2 dedicated commuter or regional, or I mean weekend excursion trips during the week that would connect with Sounder. Next slide. And there are all kinds of opportunities to bring new revenue to this service. Weekend excursions to Blaine and Bellingham Winery, the Sounders games, Tulalip Cedar Ski to the festival. Lots of opportunities for groups to charter the train and bring additional revenue. Next slide. I mentioned the freight and decongesting freight in Blaine. There are some great opportunities here to improve the rail infrastructure in and around the city. Next slide. This is a picture of a mixed manifest train at Blaine. Next slide. This is West Shore Terminal. This is where all those coal trains are headed, the Delta Port, just across the border. And BNSF is operating 2 to 3 trains a day to this particular facility. Next slide. And you all heard about the proposal for Cherry Point to build the Gateway Pacific plant. If this goes through and is permitted, those coal trains that are now crossing the border into Canada will not go that far. They will not go to Blaine. They will turn off at Custer and access that facility. Next slide. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail here. Suffice it to say that north of the border, there are 3 Class 1 railroads that cause a lot of congestion, and they're trying to figure out how to make investments in the corridor. Next slide. This is what you should pay attention to. There's $365 million of Canadian money across the border going in this Roberts Rail Corridor from Abbotsford over to Saracen, and we're trying to work a deal as part of the third round trip so that the Canadians, through their Asia-Pacific Gateway, would invest in the BNSF North-South Corridor as part of this plan, which would allow us the capacity for the third round trip. Next slide. And these are the details of the Roberts Bank Rail Corridor. It's interesting because it's a single track, and 18 to 20 trains a day operate on from 3 different railroads. We have a single track between Blaine and Everett, and we have 14 trains a day that operate. They're going to 40 trains a day, and the reason they're going to be able to do that, next slide, is because of this. They're putting in this incredible overpasses along the Roberts Rail Corridor. This happens to be in Surrey. Next slide. Now, getting back to Blaine, and I'll turn it over to my colleagues, we think the idea for the boardwalk is fabulous. It's one of the most interesting transit-oriented development plans in the state, but we think the rail station could add a lot to this. Next slide. And that's what we have now. And another time we would suggest that we bring some folks here from Olympia that actually built the station with $700,000 of donated labor, and they staff the station in Olympia Lacey with all volunteer crew. So it doesn't have to be a burden on the Blaine taxpayers. It can be done through a variety of sources, and the operating costs can be taken care of by a larger region, not this, just the city of Blaine. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Councilor Hunt from Surrey.
Just a slight correction. All that $360 million isn't for one overpass in Surrey. There are, if my memory serves me, there's about seven overpasses, four of which are in Surrey. But just to give you a geography lesson, I was first elected to Surrey Council in 1987, and this, to my recollection, is the first time that I have ever been to Blaine Council, our neighbors. So it's good to see your neighbors. I'm sorry that's taken so long to come say hello. But Surrey, we're one of 24 member municipalities that make up the Metro Vancouver Regional District. You can see our size, 122 square miles, half a million residents out of the 2.4 which is Metro Vancouver today. If you'd next slide, I believe you call them urban growth boundaries here in the States, but the green is what we refer to as the agricultural land reserve. So one-third of Surrey is in the agricultural land, and it will stay that way permanently. So these other areas are growth areas. The city center, for example, is where we're building the next downtown for Metro Vancouver, and those are the rest of our communities. South Surrey, affectionately referred to as White Rock, although we have the official members from recognizing White Rock's about 17,000, and I think we got about 80,000 surrounding them that continues to grow. If you want to move to the next slide, just to give you an idea of the growth that we have is over the last 6 years we've dealt with $6 billion in construction activity. Our estimated population will be 760,000 in approximately 2041. Within the next decade or so, we will, in fact, population-wise, be larger than Vancouver. We already are as far as children are concerned, but that will be coming along. Next slide. Just gives you the concept of the growth that we've had, where Vancouver has grown by about 51%, we've grown by 367% over the last 40 years. So it's booming, and as I said, we have the largest school district in British Columbia, more kids, so we know where the future is going to be and what's going to continue to happen. On to the next slide is dealing with our building of a transit-friendly city. Of course, it's a challenge because we're the new Vancouver is the old and they have it established. But just so you get a concept of the densities that we're putting in our city center, we're going to be at 7.5, will be the floor area ratio. So if you don't deal with those terms, that's basically saying if you have an acre of land, we're going to build 7.5 acres worth of property on top of that acre of land. Simple way to say it. So a lot of people, very high density. Each one of our town centers is 2.5 is the densities we're putting in there. A great shift has happened in the city to multifamily, where it used to be single-family residential, the classic 7,200 square foot lot. Now a lot is usually about 3,000 square feet, and we're putting in more multifamily than we are single-family. So that continues to be the future. On to the last slide for my section, anyhow, is dealing with Surrey's vision concerning transportation. Obviously, we have a challenge. We're very car-dependent. We want to change that. SkyTrain is the provincial government's transportation of choice. We'd rather have it on the ground. We like Portland's model with the light rail on the ground, and so that's what we're trying to propose to the provincial government, the green being the light rail, blue being bus rapid transit getting down to South Surrey White Rock area. And what we've done in Surrey in support of the, in support of the Amtrak stop here is just so that you get the concept, for us to go and take the current Amtrak, we're taking at least an hour to get into Vancouver, to go through all the normal customs and everything else, to take an hour to come back out here, so 2 hours wasted to come back to where we started from in the first place. So for the residents of Surrey, Langley, Delta, you know, White Rock, it just makes sense for us to be able to come across the border ourselves, and that takes however minutes the lineup happens to be at that particular time of the day. Park in here, even if we park on the Canadian side and simply walk, it's not that far to the border here. We can make the arrangements with transit. That's one part of our plans to be able to do. So that we just see this as being such a time saver for us. You've seen the same thing with Bellingham Airport. We're trying to promote the Abbotsford Airport, and the reality is I'm sorry, Bellingham just makes a lot of sense. You clear customs right away. You've got a very quick onto the plane, and away you go. The fees are less down here. So it's one of those ones that the Blaine train station, Amtrak station, just makes a lot of sense to us, which is why we passed this resolution at Surrey Council in support of it. And I've already circulated to you the attached letters that we have already sent concerning it, and we will continue to be and do whatever you need us to be to help support this initiative, because we see it as a great opportunity for us south of the Fraser. Thank you. And now I believe that I turn it over to Grant Meyer from the City of White Rock.
Thank you very much, Mayor and Councillor, for having us here tonight and taking the time to hear us out. I want to give a little history on White Rock and South Surrey and the area, and how we wanted to get a stop originally there in 2001 to serve the areas of Surrey, both Langley's Delta, White Rock, basically south of Metro Vancouver region, for that access to Seattle, Portland, and beyond. Things were going along quite well, and then we had the terrorist attacks of 9/11, and that threw everything off the rails, no pun intended. And anyways, everything went hush for many years. A couple of years ago, we looked at restarting it, and the fact of the matter is there's just a lot of hurdles that would be very difficult to overcome. There's parking an issue. We have 830 stalls on our beach, but they're full from May till, that's right, Ken, and they give us a lot of revenue. $3 an hour, 24-hour day, we couldn't charge someone. I think it's about $4 a night to park in Bellingham. Is that right, Bruce? Yeah. I mean, we couldn't afford to even hold off 50 stalls, let alone 100 or however many would be. Also, customs, security issues, upgrading the train station, having customs come in a van, as they do in Vancouver, load up, come here, clear the trains, etc. It would be too much time delay. So when this item came up about saving a train station, and Bonnie was, I'm glad to say, invited me to the meeting a month and a bit ago, I thought this was the ideal situation for, obviously, you guys as a city, but also for the South Fraser region. So I think there's huge benefits both sides of the border. I never actually walked around that harbor area, but we walked around there after the meeting. There's lots of room for parking, I believe, compared to us anyway. So, and a lot of the things that Councillor Hunt mentioned, you can't backtrack into Vancouver. You can almost drive to Seattle in that time. Another thing about going to Bellingham to catch the station or catch the train there is you waste X amount of time, and a lot of people, by the time they get to Bellingham, they just say, oh, I'll just keep driving, right? I think last year we decided to drive, my wife and myself. We paid $36 a night for parking for three nights. I think the train fare would have been well below that and the gas savings. So, anyways, I think there's huge potential here for both sides of the border. I think we could have parking on both sides of the border. I think some people are going to get dropped off by family and friends and walk across. I think transit could come down a little closer to the border and drop off, walk off passengers. And I think it would do a heck of a lot for your community. And I wish you all the best in your efforts to save the station. And I'm pleased to announce it's on our agenda, a motion similar to Surrey's for next Monday. We've been on a spring break here and haven't had a meeting in a while. And another thing, after I left the meeting, and Marvin was there, and Surrey Board of Trade, and White Rock, and I got thinking after, and I talked to Martin on the phone, and I said, let's talk to the other communities up here. And I called Langley City. I called Langley Township. I called Delta. And I called Cloverdale Chamber of Commerce, Sosury White Rock Chamber of Commerce. And they were all very enthusiastic. I emailed Bonnie. They all wanted to be included in this. Some of them have meetings tonight, so they couldn't make it. I wanted to invite them down as guests, but they're all very supportive, and I hope they're going to make it out. And I've heard that a couple of them are considering motions as well. So best of luck, and thank you again for having us.
Thank you, Councillor. Would you three gentlemen be willing to take any questions in case any of the council or the audience has any questions they'd like to ask? If you you can make a question, but would you come to the podium, state your name, and then ask the question?
My name is Carl King. I live at 4283 Bay Road. And it's my question is, how many of you have ever ridden the Amtrak? Okay, I've ridden the Amtrak from here to Seattle. I've ridden it from here to Chicago, and from Chicago down to St. Louis, and then I've also ridden it back. It's an incredible ride. It is the most fun you'll ever have. You can read your books, you get to meet great people, and you can watch incredible views. Going over the Rockies on the way to Chicago is just mind-blowing. The beauty of the mountains going through in winter, fabulous. I think we're missing an incredible opportunity here with gas prices rising. It costs, I think, $26 to go from Bellingham to Seattle. And with gas, you're going to be paying $40, $45. There's a lot of people who would take the Amtrak to Seattle or Mount Vernon or Everett and not drive and avoid all that hassle. So I really hope this happens because it's going to be fabulous for our area. Thank you.
Rodney, would you come forward, please, and state your name and ask the question, please?
Well, my fellow councilman, I have to put that in there. Hi, Mike. And he had the right name for me tonight. He called me the old goat.
Yeah.
And that's what we used to be called on the old Great Northern. 67 years ago, I was elected to the city council. And the only job I ever quit was the city council. And I quit, and I had 3 more months to go, and they asked me to be track supervisor between Bellingham and Vancouver. And we had 4 passenger trains a day at that time, 2 up and 2 down. And I talked with Bonnie here and some of the others, and I was always been very sad when we let some of our politicians go and make our railroads emerge the way they did. And so the Great Northern Railroad was the only major railroad that was never subsidized by the federal government. And those of us that worked for the Great Northern was a family. And I mean, it was really a family. It was a wonderful place to work. And then the merger come along, Mr. Swift and a lot of them, they thought that was a good idea. It was, for the companies to get together. They didn't have no competition anymore. They could raise their tariffs to any way they wanted, and that's what they're doing yet. But they should have kept the passenger service on. Our congressmen and some of those people, they made a lot of money getting Amtrak. But you people don't understand that, but that's what happened. And they just run that the way they wanted to. And that's why we don't have no train here in Blaine anymore. I don't know how come a little town like Stanwood, they got to stop down there, and we can't get one here. So I support your plan 100,000%. If we can get that train to stop here again, our Canadian friends, they need it, we need it, and I'll be glad to work with anybody to try and get that going. Thank you.
Good. Thank you, sir. Thank you. If you'd like to come forward and state your name, question.
Hi, my name's Bill Beck. Of course, you're Coins and Antiques, and I've written a few letters, and I'm very passionate about this project. I really thank Bruce and Mr. Hunt and Mr. Grant for coming here and speaking on behalf of the train station and the community. All I'd like to say is this is a win-win deal all the way around, and I would hope that this thing gets pushed through and we do everything we can to make this happen as soon as possible. I know time's of the essence, but I think the ball's rolling in the right direction, and I sure look forward to buying my first ticket.
Thank you.
So, thank you.
Well, Joe, we really do appreciate you being here, and we hope that you will...
I'm Lois Snelling, and I live at 1300 Peace Portal, and I have a ticket on the train on Wednesday. Mm-hmm. I ride the train because I am a single person, and perhaps it isn't wise for me to drive. I drive my car to Bellingham, and there's a place there where I can park it with security and then pick it up when I come back. Hi, Charlie.
Thank you, Lois. Hope that you gentlemen will continue to keep us informed as to how things are going, and that you will take the opportunity to keep us updated. You're welcome back at any time. We'd love to pursue this with you, and we hope that we'll hear from you very shortly.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. May I just say one little thing? I really appreciate you coming and passing the resolutions that you're passing in support of this train stop. It means a lot to us, and I think it's going to be very key because this has to be looked upon as a regional train stop, not a Blaine train stop. This is regional to serve that big circle that we looked at on the map there, and I would like council to be discussing about writing a letter to the governor in support of putting a Blaine regional stop on the Department of Transportation's master plan. That can be a big first step for us to do. So that will be happening shortly, I believe. So thanks again. Appreciate it.
Thank you. The next order of business is written communications. Sanchez.
Bye-bye.
You got to hang around the story. You got to come in the door. You're here for the duration.
Thank you very much.
Did you give Bruce?
Yeah.
You guys care? No, we got to know anyone else. That is the part.
After this.
Bet there'd be more questions about the people.
16th.
Sanchez.
No, this is I downloaded.
Thank you. Anything else?
Bonnie did forward an email that she had next to me, and I didn't know where it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I will respond to that.
Okay.
Next item is commission, committee, and board reports. First off, for Councilman Kottner, is the Blaine Economic Development Advisory Committee.
Which one?
Blaine Economic Development
Advisory. No report.
How about the Northwest Economic Council?
I found out this evening that they've reorganized, got a new board, and we're not on.
Please. The Northwest Economic Council has a much smaller board now. And my understanding is that there is not a designated seat for the city of Blaine on it anymore. So,
or even small cities.
Or well, I,
there was some discussion at one point about going to the small cities and asking for one representative. I don't think they actually even did that, frankly.
They haven't returned a phone call for 3 months, so I think we're out.
Okay. How about Councilman
Popular,
the Blaine Tourism Advisory Committee?
No report.
Okay. Bonnie, do you have anything on the RED Loan Committee?
Yeah. There is no chamber report, but we did approve a loan for an existing restaurant business to relocate, and so we're wishing them well.
Councilman Hawkins on the Drayton Harbor Shellfish Advisory.
I missed two meetings. I had to work.
WTA.
WTA, Councilman Greener.
There will be a public hearing Thursday, 6 o'clock, in the County Council Chambers to discuss additions to the existing routes. To the best of my knowledge, none of them directly affect Blaine, however.
Okay. Councilman Hawkins on the Library Committee.
Same night.
No report.
Yeah.
Okay. Councilman Olson.
No report.
Mr. Jones, could we have a report on the Planning Commission, please?
I did want to just bring up one item at the Planning Commission. A gentleman from the SRA board, Ken Rathel, has attended the Planning Commission meeting recently and wrote them a letter related to a potential code amendment to classify incomplete buildings or incomplete development projects as blight. He sees that as a way of reinforcing the city's ability to address those buildings and potentially have them removed, torn down, and the sites revitalized. The Planning Commission ultimately decided that that was something that they weren't going to initiate. The Planning Commission has authority to initiate code amendments, and they referred Mr. Rathel to possibly consider discussing that with the City Council. So he may come to one of your meetings to bring that up, and I wanted to let you know that that had happened at Planning Commission.
Thank you. How about the Parks and Cemetery Board?
No report, sir.
Chief, if we have anything on the Law and Justice Council?
There's been no meeting, and we have no report, sir.
Thank you. Small Cities Caucus. Gary, would you like to comment on that, since you and I were both there?
The primary discussion at the Small City Caucus was Steve Jolk from the Public Utility District talking about the water planning that is happening in the watershed and the use of EDI funds to do some work that would involve the PUD and some others in the area. So Jack Laos was at the meeting, and Richard Little was representing the City of Bellingham. And so it was a good discussion. We approved a letter to go to the County Council supporting the project that the PUD is kind of heading up. What else did we do? We had a discussion about the changes that are happening with the EDC and with John, what's his last name?
Mitchner,
mm-hmm. Moving from the EDC to the port to work with Dodd Snodgrass in economic development, which, by the way, I personally think, and I think Ken probably will agree, is that that's a real good team. John and Dodd are going to do a very good job, I think. They work well together, and they're both very knowledgeable, and so that's going to benefit all of us, I think. But the question came up is that a number of the cities provided funds. We put $10,000 into the CEV, and now they're not doing the work that they used to do, and that's going to the SBDC, and wondering where our $10,000 went. And so we're trying to get a meeting with the representative from Western and talk about that, as to where the money is and how is it going to be used. And we're not the only community. There's a number of other communities that have helped fund the Center for Economic Vitality, is what it's called. So that came up, and a letter was sent, was prepared and will be sent to the Western Washington University asking for that meeting to occur. Other than that, a few reports, and that was about it.
Whatcom Council of Governments, there was a meeting held on March the 21st. It was really the 2012 Transportation Improvement Program was discussed, and the Surface Transportation Program was updated. And at that meeting, a new executive director was selected. And I'm not sure whether he has accepted the position or not. I believe I had an email that he had, but I haven't gotten the details of it yet. So hopefully that contract has been worked out, and he'll come on board in a few weeks' time.
Is that Gordon or somebody else? Okay. And IMTC, do you want to mention that meeting?
No, you go ahead. You were there.
Well, it was a regular meeting of the core group, they call it, of the IMTC, International Mobility Trade, and you didn't.
I had the flu.
You weren't there.
You said you were going. I left you to you. I'm sure you represented us well.
Yeah, Harry was there also, and actually Chief Haslip was there. And it was their, I can't say there was anything highlighted, would you say, Chief? Or Harry, that was other than the usual discussions from the various agencies. That's about a twice a year meeting that we have, and I think it's going to take place again in September, I think they said. So that's all.
Yeah, what struck me was the coordination between Canadian and the U.S.
Yeah, it's an excellent group.
Groups that are involved.
It really is. And I think
they're working well together.
I think the IMTC can play a pretty significant role in getting this Blaine stop, because it all centers on transportation, obviously, and so I'm sure as time goes on we will be enlisting some support from members of this core group and the steering committee, which is a separate, smaller group, in supporting the train stop as well, so they can be helpful.
Okay, if no other reports, those switch to the city manager and staff reports.
Okay, let's begin with
city manager.
Public Works Director, Raymond.
Good evening. I wanted to give you a bit of an update on a few items. First, our wastewater conveyance project. Actually, I'm going to give you a little bit of an update later on when we talk about the change order. So thought I'd combine those. But on the street topic, we had previously brought forward to you our plan to bid and award Marine Drive in the hopes of getting it built before the July 4th celebration. That is not going to come to pass. I wanted to let you know that. We are going to be working a little further with the Planning Commission on some of the trail design and so forth, and we do not want to rush that effort, so we're going to go ahead and switch tides a little bit and get out the Peace Portal project first. So still staying pretty active there, and I actually in some ways I think that might be a better fit in terms of trying to take advantage of the construction window and saving some costs. Peace Portal is the project that actually has the tightest budget, so getting that out earlier will actually help. Wanted to let you know that we received a petition from the Department of Ecology to have Blaine essentially combined with Birch Bay in the sense of meeting the population requirements for a National Pollution Discharge Permit. We are working with DOE on that. We have
an opportunity to provide some feedback, which we are working with our consultant on, and we are going to be meeting with them on April 12th. So we'll continue to keep you apprised from that. It could have huge financial ramifications to the city if the city is considered part of that permit, have additional requirements for reporting and testing and so forth. So we're going to do whatever we can to provide them with the input that they need to hopefully realize that this petition is not warranted. There has also been a request for me to look into whether or not there might be some funding sources available for retrofitting streetlights with LEDs. We've made some contact with the Transportation Improvement Board. I've discussed that with our project manager down there, and I've also followed that up with an email essentially offering to be kind of a test case if they would like to do kind of a demonstration project. So hopefully we'll hear some more about that in time to come.
Thanks. Are there any questions for Raven? I just want you to know that she's been doing a great job.
Super.
I think we'll keep her.
Yeah.
I've asked Chief Haslip if he would update you on some changes that are being made on the truck route that impact our city.
Probably salient if any of you took phone calls about the traffic backups this past week. I think the combination of events brought about the backups that you saw every night this past week, except for, I think, Wednesday, we had significant multi-hour delays at both border crossings. Part of it is simply because Pacific Highway is transitioning from a 5-passenger lane port to a 10-passenger lane port. They're in the process of doubling the number of passenger lanes. They will have as many on the truck route when they get done as they now have at Douglas on the I-5 crossing. That will be a significant improvement or throughput for us. However, they're trying like heck to get it done within the next month or so, but it takes a little while, and in the meantime, they only have 2 lanes open at Pack Highway. They're moving the traffic through as quickly as they can, but there are only so many horses you can put through the gate in an hour, and that was part of what we've seen in the last week. The biggest part of what we saw in the last week, however, was spring break for all our K-12 friends up north, and a lot of folks came down to do business and visit. So, in order to assist with that, our office had officers each night of the week that we were able at both SR-543 on both the truck route and on at 2nd and D Street. We've received a lot of thank yous and compliments from the folks on who utilize both the border crossings. So long as we have funding and we have assistance for funding from our federal partners, we'll try to continue that. My hope and sense is after the spring break, after we get the additional lanes at Pack Highway, perhaps we'll see a reduction in the amount of time we have to spend out there. WashDOT has helped out in the interim by placing variable message signs, big orange battery and generator driven signs at both I-5 northbound at 276 and on D Street at the truck route, in part to help protect the Nexus Link and in part to help just provide a sense to the traveling public that there is governance there, that it is an area where the Wild West doesn't rule. They should try to stay in their own lane. WashDOT has tried to dovetail signage improvements to the Pacific Highway crossing so that they come into play at about the same time the Pacific Highway opens its new lanes. They're running a few weeks behind. So it looks like that Pack Highway will have their new lanes open and operational, and within a few weeks after that, WashDOT will have additional signage in place. They will have
plastic cones marking the northbound Nexus lane, just as we have southbound at the Peace Arch now that has proved to be so effective for us. They want to make the northbound Nexus lane from the truck, from D Street onto the truck route, a Nexus-only lane, so that our Nexus traveling public always has a way to use the Nexus lane to get to the border, which I think would be a great asset. If you live on along Highway 99 and you have to go over and use a truck route, it's only 3 or 4 minute jog back to 99 on 8th Avenue. And in fact, I used it just a couple of nights ago, and it is definitely the way to go. So that is something WashDOT hopes to have in place by May. I talked with Mark Pulse from WashDOT today, and June is the latest, but they're trying for the second week of May to have their lanage improvements in place as well. We've seen a significant reduction in the number of complaints we've taken from the motoring public. The only issue I'm working through at this time, I did receive a call from one of the brokerage firms wondering about how their employees should win their way through the new way of doing business in order to get their employees to work when there are traffic jams because they used to use the Nexus lane. So we're working through that. Gary, anything in particular? Anything else I should bring up?
I think you covered it.
Okay. If I'll keep you posted as
I'm sorry. Did you talk about the D Street
workaround?
State
Patrol or not State Patrol? WashDOT wants to make sure that if you're in Blaine and you come east on D Street and you run into that sign that says Nexus Only, they don't want to leave people just abandoned with no trailblazing signage to let them know what to do. So we're working on the signage now that the interim proposal is we want to see what happens if folks can go south and use the southbound ramp off of D onto the truck route and use that to get to the end of the lane. In Washington State, it is legal to make a U-turn at an intersection, and they're proposing signage to make it clear that someone can come down the truck route and at either H Street or Boblet, as is appropriate, just make a U-turn there when the light is yours and get into the end of the line and continue northbound so that if you want to use the truck route, it is still available to you. We haven't cut that off, that resource.
That's legal.
Yes.
Legal?
Yeah. At an intersection. Unless otherwise signed, it is legal to do so.
Has there been any discussion about changing the hours on Nexus southbound?
I would have to defer to customs on that. They have, just over the last couple of months, implemented a firm set of crossing hours. It's still, I think it's 9 o'clock when it cuts off southbound at Peace Arch. And that's
6.
And 6 over at the other side. Before that, it was kind of hit and miss. And they kind of closed it down when it looked like traffic was lighting up, but they're now committed to firm hours. So,
Well, first of all, as a frequent border crosser, thanks for stepping in and doing that. I know a lot of it is because of the financial assistance that you guys are getting to be able to have the officers out there on overtime. But I called Todd at WashDOT today to thank him for the signs, and I want to thank you guys, too. Several times this past week we crossed, including on Saturday night. And, boy, on Saturday night, I don't think we probably would have just gone home had we not had the work you guys were doing out there because we wouldn't have been able to get out.
I was in the same boat. I was very glad to see my character.
So, thank you.
By the way, that's a pretty scary sign. It says Nexus only $124, right, or something like that.
That's what started the fire. And our response is the Nexus card is a whole lot less expensive.
That's right.
Okay.
City manager?
Anything else for Mike? All right. Let's go to Michael in community development.
I just have a really brief update on the Banner Bank building. Not a whole lot really to say. Not a lot happening right now except for planning with the floor plan for the move and planning for AV and security and those sorts of things.
We are reviewing a second, we are on the second plan review from the architect and working on some other design and signage and furniture questions, but everything continues to move ahead. Immigration law, which is one of the tenants that is changing suites with the purchase, is moving on Friday and expects to open up on Monday on the first floor suite.
Okay, that's all. All right, any questions for Michael?
No comment. The cookie or teller wrote a nice letter.
Yeah,
it was just
very nice letter.
I thought that was pretty nice of her. Mm-hmm. We helped her too, but then that was good.
Okay, Jeff, you noticed that Jeff isn't here this evening. He's got a couple things going on in his family, not the least of which is his son is crossing over tonight. For you scouters, you know, that means he's going from being a Weeblo to a Boy Scout. And so I told him that was more important than sitting here and crossing over. From sanity.
I think we passed that.
Yes. Sherry, do you have anything?
No report.
Thank you. Couple things. You know, at the last meeting, there was some discussions about the Simiamu master plan and updating that and communication and those types of issues, and I just wanted to respond to a couple of things that have happened since then. One is that I'm told there continues to be, some real suspicion that there are activities going on that over in that area we're not telling anybody about, that there's some things in the mill that that are going to happen. Just to dispel any rumors, that is not the case. We primarily Michael, but periodically I get involved. There has been a lot of interest in property in that area since Simiamu, since the investor took the property back from Trillium. Just as you would expect in any kind of real estate, there have been lookers and people who are, looking at the property and come in and talk to Michael and want to know, this and want to know that and what can you do and what can't you do. And there's a lot of that kind of tire kicking going on, a good deal of interest in property in that area, and they ask a lot of questions, and that's our job to answer them the best that we can. But I can tell you that at this point we do not have any applications for anything. In that area, there are no pre-app meetings scheduled for anybody that's looking at any project over there. Doesn't mean that there's not going to be, but right now there isn't anything like that. So, like to the best I can dispel any rumors that there's something going on that nobody knows about except us. It's just not the case. But on the other hand, there is a good deal of interest in property in this whole area, and that will probably continue. Let's see. Oh, the other thing I was going to mention is that Rod Smith. Some of you know Rod. Some of you don't know Rod. Rod has been with the city for how long? Raven, do you know? Lots of years.
Right? 20-some, 25 maybe.
25, 26 years. He works in public works. He's an engineering tech Also does our GIS, our geographic information systems work. He's a encyclopedia of information about property and about infrastructure in the city. Has been a wonderful employee for the city of Blaine. I've never asked him for something that he hasn't provided, you know, in short order and really good work. Rod is retiring, and his retirement reception will be this Friday, and from helping two to four.
Yep.
Here in is it City Hall, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. It's good to know what's going on.
right here.
But if you know Rod and want to come by and wish him well, you're certainly invited to do that, and I think it would mean a lot to him. But a great employee, he's going to be tough to replace, but he's already got a few fishing trips that that he's planning. Other than that, I have nothing else, so unless you have some questions, that's it for our staff report.
Can I add one thing on the semi-automatic topic?
Mr. Mayor, I just wanted to mention that I did talk with Len Saunders, who's the SRA board liaison between the City Council, and he comes to all the just about all these meetings, and he reports back to SRA. I did meet with Len and talk with him about an offer to come and visit with the board and talk with them about the properties that are either recently sold or are available for sale, and what the master plan says for those properties. And Ken relayed that to the board, and he said that they will likely have me at the next meeting. So far, nothing's scheduled, but it looks like that's probably going to happen. I periodically go to their meetings to just kind of give them an update on things, and we'll probably do that next meeting.
Michael, would it be helpful to have a new map developed that shows who owns what over in Semiahmoo? We all know that Trillium owned everything at one time. That's no longer the case, but I don't know who the new owners are, and I don't know what they own.
We can do our best to put together that map. The county assessor is not super fast on getting that information loaded in. A lot of properties change hands, but we can do our best to do that. It's not, when we do that, it's not always current of the most recent property owner, and I would be... wouldn't be happy to put out a map that then people said, well, this wasn't even accurate. But, yeah, we can definitely look into that.
You know, the other thing I want, I think, that needs to be clarified, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I believe we had a letter or an agreement that Trillium provided to us that they would not submit any new projects for development until such time as the master plan had been revised and approved by City Council. Is that correct? My memory correct in that?
I believe there was an agreement with Trillium that they would...
I can't hear you, Michael.
I was going to say that I believe there was an agreement with Trillium to not bring forward any more development projects without an update of the master plan, so that update could be included at that time.
That is not going to be binding on any new property owners. Is that correct?
That's right. It's not. It was an agreement between two parties, a contract between one party and another, or an agreement between one party and another. It's not a binding law or condition of project approval. It's between Trillium and the city.
That does that have to be legally withdrawn?
Probably not.
No, not in my opinion. I'm not a lawyer, but I don't believe so.
Trillium has, do they have any interest in what remains of the undeveloped parts of Semiahmoo?
What do you mean by any interest?
I mean, do they own anything, or do they have an ownership share percentage?
I believe so, but again, Mr. Mayor, we don't track ownership. We don't get involved in real estate transactions, so I'm really not sure.
Okay.
people are free to sell the property. We don't regulate the sale of the property. So Trillium may have some property left where they may have sold the last.
I was just wondering, and just off, this is off the top of my head, whether it would be a benefit to for us to approach the now new owners to find out if they would like to participate in an update or revision of the master plan so that they would have some opportunity to provide input into how they think that should be developed.
Well, certainly if we were in a position to update the master plan or if we were pursuing an update of the master plan at this point, we would invite all the property owners and all the stakeholders.
Okay. So we would do that automatically?
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to get some clarification, Charlie.
Yeah, I just want a question on Michael's... The Chad Thai Shoreline Substantial, where is that at?
Well, you know where the Chad Thai restaurant is now? It's in the shoreline jurisdiction area, so it's on their current site.
If they want to do anything, they have to do the shoreline.
Yeah, if they want to do what they want to do, they need to get a shoreline permit. Any development over $5,700 and some odd dollars requires a shoreline substantial development permit when it's within that certain zone, certain area. And they're just within it by a few feet, but they're in.
All right, thank you.
City Manager, do we have any other reports or?
No, that's it, Mayor.
Okay, and the calendar as provided is up to date and current? Nothing else to be added?
No, I don't believe so.
Okay. Here. Yes.
Michael, have you had any new requests for people going on to the Planning Commission?
Sherry's received one application.
Okay. I received one application, and just today I left a voice message for someone who left me a voice message who was interested in what was going on that, and so I haven't heard back from that person yet.
Any further questions?
Yeah, I have a question. Where do you advertise that, Sherry? Just on our website, or you put it in the newspaper?
It's in the newspaper. I think we got it advertised on the bulletin board, I think
it is,
but, and there may have been something in the website. I have to go back and
it doesn't pay enough, does it?
Unfortunately. Okay, the next item on the agenda is public hearings, and I believe we have none this evening. Next item is the consent agenda. We're looking for approval of the payables in the amount of, I think it's $141,158.90, and approval of the March 12, 2012 City Council minutes.
So moved.
Second.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Passed 7-0. Next item is council action items. The first item is a resolution 1604-12, council rules of procedures. Mr. City Manager, is that you're going to present that?
Sherry?
Back last year, the council had two study sessions, one on April 25th and the other on May 9th, and we reviewed our resolution 1321-01, which was our rules of conduct that had been in place since 2001. During those two study sessions, and it was attended by staff, council, and city attorney, we had some discussions on what was going on with the resolutions as far as being outdated, any issues with conflicts with RCWs, what the council proposed, what the staff proposed. And based on those study sessions, and almost a year later, I apologize for it, but put together the resolution with some, there are some substantial changes in it, mostly I think some of the big things are I created the table of contents. I changed it from rules of conduct to rules of procedure, which is what most cities go by now. And let's see here. Went through and basically what our discussions were during those study sessions. I did have a meeting with Gary at one point so that we could have a little bit further discussion on it. And I did get some input also from Bruce Ryan, who reviewed the proposed resolution. And he only had a couple of items that he brought up that were incorporated in the proposed resolution here. And let's see. Trying to think, audio recordings, one of the things that we had discussed, which is Rule 5 on page, I guess it's page 6 here. We're not required to actually record any meetings unless it has to do with land. But the city does record all meetings right now in the discussion. We have talked about not recording the study sessions because there's no action taken at study sessions. And so that was built into this resolution. Regular council meetings, by resolution, we will provide the council meetings for the next year before the end of the year instead of after the first, which made more sense. That way people would know at least when the first council meeting was of the new year. Special city council meetings. Just a cleanup of notification based on the changes that have been made and allowed through the RCWs. Nothing other than what was discussed with the executive sessions, which remain pretty much the same with a little bit of rewording on that. Notices of hearings. There was just a little bit of, again, after some discussion, just a little bit of cleanup of how that would be handled. Council meeting agendas within 24 hours as per allowed by RCW before the next regular scheduled council meeting, but that would also be for a special meeting that we would have. Rules of order would be based on Robert's Rules of Order as interpreted by the City Council. We used to base it on a specific version that's out of date and was hard to get a hold of for new council members. And that the rules, again, interpreted by City Council, City Attorney, or City Manager. We did review the layout of our agendas, and that's under Rule 15, Order of Business. Some change in words to be council members, just how it's spelled out as far as the forum. Substantial in most of it. We still have the two reading rule for ordinances. Resolutions don't require them. appearance of fairness doctrine on Rule 28 comes out of, pretty much out of the RCW. You have two copies. One is would be the clean draft, and one is where all the changes were made.
Dennis, did you have a question?
Yes, on page 11 of the cleaned up document, D.
Could you repeat that, Dennis, please?
Page 11 of 18, and it's Rule 21D.
Oh, the misspelling there?
No, I don't understand that whole thing.
Every member who is in attendance at the city council meeting, when the question is put, shall cast their vote. Any city council member who fails to vote without a valid disqualification shall be declared to have abstained from voting on the question. So if, let's say you don't recuse yourself, or in other words, declare that you wouldn't be voting, it would be considered to be an abstention. In order for any motion to have passed, at a minimum, the majority of the aye and nay votes cast must be aye votes, and with a minimum of 3 aye votes.
Are we talking 6 people now, or are we talking 7? Or?
Well, if you have anybody who abstains, then you'd still have 6 people voting on a full council.
But if you have a minimum of 3 aye votes, you must have also a minimum of 3 nay votes. So what happens to the motion?
Fails.
Fails.
Mm-hmm.
Ties fail.
The tie fails.
Well, in order for a motion to have been passed, at a minimum, the majority of the aye and nay votes cast must be aye votes.
So that would be 5-2.
Then why is the minimum of 3 aye votes written in there?
Well, if there's an abstention there, then the abstention is considered no vote, or it would be, Gary, that would actually be then, if you've got 3 nays, 3 ayes, and an abstention, then it carries for the ayes because of the abstention.
It carries for the nays.
It has to be 4-2 to carry. If there's 6 people, you can't. If it's 3-3, it's
an abstention counts towards quorum. It can't count towards a vote one way or the other.
It can't, yeah. For a motion
to
pass with 6 people,
this,
you'd have to have it 4.
Well,
if there were 2 abstentions or 2 recusals, then you'd be left with 5 voters, and a 3-2 vote would carry.
Yes.
And if you got 6 people,
a 3-3 vote, it fails.
Yep. It has to be 4-2 to pass.
Yeah, it does have to be a majority.
You know what would make that read better? That it is confusing as hell.
Well, I don't know about that part.
Yeah.
You'll explain it, won't you?
If it read this way, forget all that other, in the last sentence, in order for any motion to have passed, leave out at a minimum. In order for any motion to have passed, the majority of the votes cast must be aye votes with a minimum of 3 aye votes. Does that make any more sense? Or did I just screw it up?
Yeah.
the votes cast must be
in order for any motion to have passed, the majority of the aye votes must, let's see, the majority of the votes, leave out that. In order for any motion to have passed, the majority of the votes cast must be aye votes with a minimum of 3 aye votes.
That makes sense.
That's better.
Yeah, that's better.
Thanks, Bob.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, is that work for you?
That makes more sense.
But you still have 3 that could vote
four
no.
4 abstain?
And they
4 abstain. 2 vote yes, 1 vote no.
Then it fails.
Yeah, it must have
you have to have 3.
Majority. Must vote A. So if there's 6, the majority has to be 4.
That's what I would pick. But that's not what it says.
He just fixed it.
It says the majority of the votes must be cast aye.
And what would be the majority out of 6?
With a minimum of 3.
4.
But if you only have 3 votes, what happens?
It doesn't
happen. It fails.
It fails.
The motion fails. If there's a tie, it fails.
Okay. Then you shouldn't have that last phrase then.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
That's what he's adjusted it.
So you're taking out with a minimum of 3 aye votes.
Could have a majority of those present. So you could have 3 people present,
but that's not quorum.
Oh, you could have 4 people present or 5 people present and have 3 aye votes.
Yeah, you're right. The majority requires that you have at least 3.
Once you drop below,
you can't just have 3 people vote because everyone else is.
I think it works if you change it.
Well, since this obviously is not something that's extremely important given the time it's taken to come back to us, how about if you guys wordsmith and bring it back and we'll deal with it at that point?
Get an outside wordsmith.
Can we pass it? Yeah. Can we pass it with
that particular section?
Well, there may be a couple of other issues, but there's no sense in us trying to rewrite it right here because we don't have to pass this evening.
But why can't we pass it?
I actually did send it to Bruce Rhine, who had read it, so and he was the one who did the training for the council and staff back in February, was it?
That's all great. What I'm saying is if we're rewriting it, we don't need to do it here on the fly. Okay, you guys can do it, and we can look at it in a corrected version.
Can't we just pass it?
Oh, we have rewritten it.
Can we just pass it now with the corrections?
It has been rewritten. Mm-hmm. And so what I think should happen is you should read it. And then if you have questions about any of them, then we can get together again and you can ask us or call, you know, ask. Say you don't understand, you don't agree. But it has been rewritten.
I understand that, Gary, but you've just changed a portion of it, and we're all sitting here discussing what the wording should now be. And what I'm saying is, I think you've heard there's a concern on this. Rather than us trying to rewrite that section yet again right now, wouldn't it be better for you guys to go figure out the way you want it and bring it back to us at that point, then?
That one section?
For that
yes.
one section.
Yeah. Well, I'm happy to do that, but on the rest of it, we need your input on the other.
I understand that. I wasn't talking about that.
Yeah. Gary, I unfortunately, because of a computer snafu, only got to see this for about 10 minutes. So I would like to have the opportunity to spend longer than 10 minutes trying to read it. And I would suggest that perhaps we take it off the agenda this evening, bring it back on the agenda for the next meeting.
That's no problem.
I move we table it.
Okay. I do have one other thing I'd like to bring up because I actually did read it. Rule 16, as it should, highlights the mayor as being the presiding officer. My question then is on Rule 14, where we were trying to make the change away from a certain edition of Robert's Rules of Order, where we suggest that interpretation then of what Robert's Rules of Order is going to be is made by the city council, city attorney, or city manager. I would think that the decision would be made by the mayor. Now, they can consult with whoever they want in that, but if they're the presiding officer, they're the ones making the determination on what Robert's Rules of Order is going to be used.
So change it from city council to mayor?
Well, it should be interpreted by the mayor. If the mayor wants to talk to the city manager or the city attorney or anyone else, they can do that. But it's the mayor who's making that determination.
Would you like to take that under advisement, Mr. City Manager? And then
sure. I think that's a good point.
Okay.
The next.
There is a motion on the floor.
I second.
And has been seconded. Is there any further discussion or comments that anyone wants
on
to make?
On this document?
To table this.
To table it. There is a motion to table it, and it's been seconded. Is there any discussion regarding the motion?
I don't think you discussed that. You don't discuss that motion.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Shall we call for a vote? All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So motion carries 7-0.
Keep your copies so that we don't have to redo these.
Okay, now to go back to the second item on the consent agenda, if my computer will operate and cooperate. Okay. The next item on the is the bid award for Tiger Construction for a reservoir tank.
Hi, Raven White Wolf Public Works. What you have before you is an award on a project that was rebid from last November. As you can see in the request for council action, by giving the bidders a closer look at the tank and opening up the bid period from 45 to 60 days did result in a bid that was approximately $40,000 cheaper than the bid in November. We have reviewed the qualifications of the contractor. We have determined them to be responsive and responsible, and therefore we request that you award the bid to Tiger Construction in the amount of $314,487.
Thank you, Raven. Any discussion?
Paul? Question. We have had a number of cases recently with change orders that some of my brothers and sisters have felt to be excessive. I postulated the possibility that somebody might look at the budget amount and see the difference between the budget amount and the award amount as free money. So my question is this. You have listed here $350,000 as budgeted for the project.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any merit in not listing such figures in the future?
You know, it's a good point and a good thing to discuss. And when we talk about the change order after this, one of my suggestions is that we have just a conversation about change orders in general. It's just a separate bid or agenda item. The conflict I see in that is I feel that it is my duty to tell you that this project is within budget. And so, you know, I could do that without listing the budget amount, but it's public information anyway. Public Works scrutinizes every change order request and brings that to you only when we have determined that it is a warranted change. I don't feel, after working with contractors for the last 20 years, that they're necessarily seeing that difference as theirs. One thing I can add to this is that part of that difference that you see between the budget amount and the bid amount is actually money that we have contracted to a consultant to help us manage the construction so that we are keeping a close eye on those types of things. So that is not all money that is available to the contractor anyway.
Thank you.
Move staff approval.
Second.
Any further questions or discussion? Call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. 7-0.
Okay.
Third item on the agenda is, if I can find it now, the Boss Construction Change Order number 6.
I actually have a little presentation for you to spice up your evening if you were. I knew that this was going to come late in your agenda, and I also wanted to
drinks.
Give you a little bit of an opportunity for.
If we thought it would help.
So, talked to you a little bit about the change order for Boss Construction. This is the final phase of the wastewater conveyance project that you have heard about many times through the course of construction. What I wanted to bring to you tonight is just a little background, kind of get you back-oriented about it, talk a little bit about the current status of the construction and where we're headed, a little bit more about the change order that we're going to be bringing to you this evening for approval, a little bit of how we evaluated that change order to determine whether it was reasonable to bring to you for approval, our recommendation for the change, and again, a little conversation about what we learned through the evaluation and how I would like to work with you in the future on future change orders and give you an opportunity to ask any further questions. So with that, this project was awarded last June. As a part of that award, the Boss Construction's qualifications were evaluated as the next low bid was over $2 million and their bid was $1.463, as you could see. After that evaluation, it was determined that we should go ahead and proceed, that they did meet the responsibility criteria. The budget for that project included two grant loan sources. The USDA Rural Development Grant Loan included approximately $2.5 million that was left over from the original Lighthouse Point construction project, as well as about $1 million for the water reclamation component of the project. That was also used as part of the construction of the pipe that went to the golf course, and that grant actually has a 25% match. Current status, we brought you an update in the middle of February. In that update, we kind of let you know that there were some fairly significant portions of the project that were remaining, and that was kind of the final tie-ins. And we also let you know that this change order that I'm bringing you tonight was pending. So what has happened between now and or then is essentially the evaluation that I told you about. Since that time, we have made official notice to the Department of Ecology that we will be decommissioning the old wastewater treatment plant. We are in the process of reviewing a final demolition plan with the Lummi tribe and hope to proceed with that plan in the very near future, such that we will receive substantial completion of the project by the end of May. In that, we're not expecting any further major changes. So we have done what we feel is the most complex component of the project. The majority of the underground work is complete. And with that, we can expect that we will be maintaining two plants for not very much longer, which is very, very good news for us. With the prior change order, your contract amount was about $1.6 million with tax. Now, when we start talking about change order 6, I wanted to show you that the changes that we are looking at all happened in this Marine Drive vicinity. This area has some pretty difficult soils to characterize, even though soils categorization was done prior to implementing the design and proceeding with construction. There still have the complex things of the old plant, the dredging that has taken place, the harbor expansion that has taken place in this area. So a very, very difficult area to characterize. So what we've encountered there, as you can see in this picture, is some very unstable soils. This was complicated by the fact that it was done late in the season, so your water table's come up a little bit. The trench box, as you can see, is not holding back the material that it was supposed to, and the trench just continued to cave in. It's creating some very unsafe conditions and also costing the contractor some additional time. So this change order is essentially compensating the contractor for that additional time and for essentially rebuilding the road through this part of the trench. in part of our evaluation, we determined, like I said, because of the time of year this was done, the fact that the alignment at that point, when you've already taken it to point B and you have point A there, there's only a short distance to connect those two dots. There wasn't a lot that we could do to change the alignment to avoid this situation or to change how we approach the situation. And it was hard to predict. Even with doing the soils assessment prior to construction, we did not realize that, you know, you can only check it in so many locations. And even with the contracts that I've done in my past, sometimes the soils are just going to be a little different, even though you've only moved, you know, 10 feet off target or something like that. This is a case where that was the case. Again, we did quite a bit of oversight. We have two consultants working on this project for us. The design consultant is doing the kind of the technical review. We also have a local consultant, Wilson Engineering, who has a construction manager, an inspector, and an engineer supervising all the work that goes on through the project. And with that level of review, all the folks working on this determined that, yes, this was fair. The prices that they were quoting us were met the industry standard. And if you look at this change order, the new contract amount of 1.715 when approved is still less than the second low bid for this contract. So if we had decided to rule out Boss Construction and go with the second low, we would be experiencing this change order, because again, there really wasn't anything we could do about it in terms of moving the pipe or anything like that, but then you would have paid that on top of the $2.028 million. So that's something pretty important to realize. One of the advantages here is by proceeding through this work through the wintertime, even though we're paying a little bit more for this change, we're able to meet our permit compliance. We're able to provide the notification to DOE that we're decommissioning the old plant, so we do not need to enter in a permit for that, or we need that permit. And we are going to be saving the maintenance of two facilities and utilizing Public Works resources more efficiently. That being said, I'm coming to you this evening with a recommendation to approve this change order. We feel that based on the complexity of the project, the difficult area in which it was constructive, and the extensive review that was provided to us by our consultants, that the amount is fair. That being said, there are some lessons learned. I actually very recently completed a change order audit with the City of Bellingham and helped to draft a change order policy for Bellingham. So change orders are something that I have a lot of experience with, and I would like to move forward with Blaine on doing a similar type of thing. I would like to work with you as a council to establish a change order policy that helps us to be more proactive, helps us to analyze risk when we're doing projects and kind of take that through a formal process, and also as director to hopefully schedule our projects such that we are reducing that risk in the future. And I welcome any questions that you may have.
Ken?
Outstanding presentation. Thank you very much. You cleared up a lot of questions about this whole project from start to finish. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this.
My pleasure.
And I'll offer my support and move approval.
Thank you.
You have a gift for making me feel good about paying more money.
I'll keep trying to.
Yeah, I believe Ken made a motion.
I seconded it if he did.
Did you make a motion?
I certainly thought I did, yes.
Seconded. Has it been seconded?
It has been.
Any further questions or discussion?
I would just like to say I think establishing that policy is just excellent idea, and totally knowing you have that experience is really great to know.
Okay.
So I welcome that process, and we'll vote for this.
Just to be on the humorous side, I'm still waiting for us to win one. It's construction companies 5, Blaine City 0. So
It is.
You'll give me the one win. I'm looking forward to it in the future.
We'll keep working on that. It is a very, very difficult climate out there right now. The contracting community is hungry. They're bidding really, really low, and they're justifiably trying to find wherever they can for those costs.
I understood my remarks were on the light side. Okay. Any other questions or discussion? Call for the vote. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carries 7-0. Okay. Any unfinished business?
Yes. I just have a question of the Public Works Director. On the Peace Portal Trail, was that going to be started and completed before the 4th of July, necessarily?
I'm working with the Assistant Director on that. I think that is our goal, yes. Again, that project is the one that is tighter in budget, and one of the things that I suggested that we consider, not me this time, one of the things I suggested we consider is opening up that contract time a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And just limit construction during that period, but I think we still have an opportunity, being as we're early, we now have the resources, because we're not doing the other project in such fast motion. I think that it's very doable.
Okay, that would be great. And just one more thing. I'm not sure if I should ask this of the chief or city manager. An update on the Wi-Fi, citywide Wi-Fi.
Oh, nothing new to report, Your Honor. I'm still working on it.
You know,
at next city council meeting.
If that's something we feel we can pursue, I'm wondering if we can use that as a marketing tool for our city.
I would sure we can. Absolutely.
That's what I'm looking forward to. So, okay, that's it.
Any other unfinished business?
Don't forget the executive session.
Okay. Just reset.
Last week, I asked about the problem on Madison, and I seen the police report this week that there has been some action taken. There will be a follow-up on that.
There's follow-up as the last follow-up was at 9:15 this morning. I can show you the photos if you like.
Is it different than the day before?
We're making incremental progress. The renter of record has obtained service, so we're good for the future going forward. We're working with him now on getting disposal of the problems you see around the residence. Pretty extensive. Once it started being gathered in the file, actually it looked worse than it did when it was spread out in the ground. We are making some progress, Dennis, and we're keeping them up.
And related to that, Gary, what's the situation with fire inspections? Now, I understand that all rentals are supposed to have a smoke detector.
I don't think we have any fire protection right now, do we, Chief? I mean, fire.
If your house catches fire, you're up
here.
Michael's office, Edgar Glevick, works with commercial building inspections and outsources those plan reviews as needed. The fire department continues to maintain their fire prevention commercial inspection services. They go around to businesses, both to provide complimentary or volunteer site inspections to businesses on things they can do to lower their risks, but also to use that as a tool that the firefighters have become familiar with, ingresses, egresses, and problems in specific structures, but that is only for commercial sites. In terms of public awareness, for instance, the change your smoke detector batteries when you roll your clocks forward and back, that we fall under the rubric of North Whatcom's overall educational ongoing prevention efforts. There are no specific fire marshal activities related to that in the city right now.
Who inspects the commercial buildings?
For everyday compliance, it's the fire service and the fire marshal's office.
The reason I ask the question is, if you look at the state fire protection, there is an RCW that says they have to be required in all units.
They're required in units when the units are constructed and the building inspector ensures that fire protection is in place, fire alarms are in place in homes and in multifamily structures and then in commercial facilities as well. You know, if someone, for instance, like if your fire alarm goes off too many times in your house when you're making toast and you get tired of it and you take it down, no one comes and inspects that you've put it back up, but we do ensure that they are in place when a structure is ready for occupancy.
I guess my concern is that these people that move into these rentals, are they guaranteed that there's a workable smoke detector in that building?
You don't do a pre-rent inspection. If you're asking if the city, if our department guarantees that, no, it's the property owner's responsibility and the renter's.
I think we need to look at what the state law says, and I think we're not doing it, and it's required. Maybe that would be something to check on, but.
Do you have the number of the RCW right there?
Yeah, I can give them to you, Mark.
That would be great, thanks.
What you would like to see is the city step forward and engage in a process.
Well, I thought when the city got out of the fire defense business and it went to the district, that they would take over those roles.
They take over those aspects of fire prevention and fire safety and firefighting that they're required to. There is no specific law that requires a fire district to have a fire marshal. They can provide fire marshaling services as they are able in conjunction with all their other services, but there is a state law that each city has a designated fire marshal. And absent a fire service, that would fall to either the building department or to the police department.
Okay, I'll give Michael the information I have.
Is there any other unfinished business? If there's not, then I would suggest that we go into executive session.
Are we going to vote on anything?
And we're going to
possibility that
discuss collective bargaining pursuant to RCW 4230-140.
Hey, thank you.
Good to see you.
Hey. I saw the tree.